It is a pleasure for me to be here. My name is Ron Gardner, as I mentioned, from Salt Lake City, Utah. And I love life. I love life. I have a wife that I absolutely adore. The weird, sort of unbelievable thing is she seems to adore me, too.
Blimey.
We have 5 boys. We didn't get any girls. We have 7 grandchildren. And 5 of them are girls. So we didn't get any daughters, but we got some granddaughters. And they know how to work grandpa. It is a pleasure to be here. I want to tell you 2 quick things, and then I'm going to really get started into the meat of what I hope to talk about, what I hope we talk about today. The first thing is that 3 or 4 years ago, I came to Maine, and I met with the president. We met at a restaurant. The restaurant was part of the hotel where I was staying. And in the room, there were 3 tables set for 8. At one table, there were 4 people. And at the other table, there were, I think, Patty, 5. The president said to me, "You know, I have a friend. And he really wanted to come, but he had a job today, and he had to go do a gig, and he wasn't able to come. But he really wants to be involved." And I said, "What's his name?" And he said, "Roger." So, "Roger, I heard your name from the very first." Well, things have changed. The president has changed. And when I walked into this room, I thought, man, we are going to feel like little ants in a real big football field. And, you know, we're almost filling this room. It's amazing.
22,
Rob. How many?
22. Wow.
Over 20 of us here today. And this isn't even a state convention. But I hope it will be many fewer than our next state convention. We have 6 months, or 7, to get ready for our state convention in the fall. Do any of you know a blind person that is not here today? Say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Every one of us do. So if you bring just one of those people, we'll have over 40 at our state convention. And if you bring one, you might as well bring 4. Because we each know a lot of blind people that could benefit from what we have, which is the truth about blindness.
I know a whole lot of people.
Okay, we have the truth about blindness, and as it says in the Bible, know the truth, and the truth will make you free. So as you learn about what blindness is and what it is not, we start learning the truth about blindness, and we start becoming free. Now, Patty, I'm going to ask you, as soon as I finish telling this next story, I want you, if you will, to remind me about a book and a couple of articles. That's all you have to say, and I'll know what I mean. Okay, I want to tell you a story that this is true, and it is unembellished. This is what happened. I went down to Florida to have a meeting very similar to this, and I got there early, and the meeting didn't really start until the next morning. We were going to have dinner that night or whatever. But the meeting really didn't start until the next morning. And this hotel happened to be on the beach. Well, you know, beach, Florida, hotel, sand. And I am from the desert. And so this was cool. And I love the water. I mean, I'm a freak for the water. I love to get in and swim, whatever. So I knew we were going to be there, so I took my swimming trunks, and I took my flip-flops, and I had a t-shirt, and I had a towel, and my sunglasses or whatever, and I decided to go out, and I was going to go swimming, which, you know, nothing special about that. So I went out, and as I was going out, the lifeguard was a little concerned about my white cane and what I was going to do and if I was going to get lost, and I thought, oh, you know, Lord, can I just have 10 minutes without having to be a blind guy, you know, where sighted people can just accept the fact that I'm going to go swimming for a few minutes. I mean, relax, world. That's what I was thinking. Okay. So I got kind of down on the beach, and there were some other people there, and you know, I was going around with my cane and just seeing what else was on there, and I hit a pole, you know, it was obviously a sign of some sort, and I thought, this will be a good place that I can find again pretty easily. Okay. So I put down my towel and, you know, pulled my t-shirt off, pulled my sunglasses off, you know, the whole thing. And, you know, I heard some sighted folks talking, and I can't hear very well, but I heard them talking about, you know, blind, and I heard them talk about, you know, I don't know, I couldn't really hear the conversation, I didn't care. So I went down into the water, and it was a little nippy, but, you know, it was ocean, and I just loved it. So I got out there in my to my ankles and to my knees and to my waist, and kind of caught my breath a little bit, and pretty soon I was swimming, and the water was over my head, and I loved to get out there and just force myself down to the bottom and then spring off the bottom up to the top and break the water and just splash back in. Now, I'm telling you this detail for a reason. I forgot about the sighted world. I was just me enjoying God's creations. And I was having a blast. Sometimes as blind people, we need to just be comfortable so that we can let down our hair. Well, if you've got any left. I don't have much. Just let your hair down and do what you want to do. So I was bobbing around, and I would take a few strokes and swim out and come back in a little closer, and then I'd go down to the bottom and force my way up and break the water again, and just having a great time. And pretty soon I was getting worn out. I mean, I'm getting a little older. And so I came out of the water, and, you know, I started kind of walking around just to hear the sounds. You know, I knew I could hear the swimming pool over there. They had a swimming pool out on the beach. And I could hear the people over there. And down the beach somewhere, somebody was playing some music on a boombox or whatever you call them these days. And, you know, so I kind of remember those sounds, and I started getting myself oriented. And I went over. Sure enough, I found my towel. And it was the right towel, which was nice.
Yeah.
And my glasses were there, so I put them on. And I noticed that there was a group of people. I could hear them not too far away, like close. And again, they were talking about blind or something. So I started paying attention, and I thought, you know, I don't want to be the subject of everybody's conversation today. I just want to relax. And finally I said, can I help you guys? And they said, well, we're just worried about you. And I said, you know, I got it. I went out, had a nice swim. I came back. I found my towel. I got this under control. I got my white cane. You know, I'm doing okay. And they said, well, we're just concerned. Did you read the sign? And I said, what sign? And they said, well, the sign that's right here. You know, this big sign right here. Well, it happened to be the pole that I was using as a home base, you know. I said, no, what sign? And they said, extreme caution, shark infested waters.
Oh, no.
Lovely.
Now, sometimes sighted people come in handy.
Say that again.
They do come in handy sometimes.
That was not a joke. It is a true story.
God.
I did not get eaten by the sharks, but apparently I was not alone in those waters.
Uh-oh.
I don't know. Maybe they don't like blubber. I don't know. But anyway.
Maybe they didn't like
I want you guys to know that we need to fit into the world. And to fit into the world, we need to learn some things about the world that we live in. And maybe the world needs some education, and maybe we need some education. Maybe both. Blindness is not thought of as a normal state of being. I mean, how many blind people are there compared to the whole population? Not very many. And what does the population think about us? Usually negative things. Am I correct?
Not too much.
Yeah. I can't go to school. I can't work. I can't drive. I can't this. I can't that. I can't that. I can't this. I could go swimming, but I didn't read the sign. And I was just proving to them that I needed sighted people to keep me safe. Well, all that as it is, the public has a belief. We call it misconceptions, misunderstanding, misbelief about our capabilities. And I'm here to tell you that as blind people, we are part of the public. So if the public believes this about blind people, and we're part of the public, what do we individually think about ourselves? What do I believe I can do? And what are my expectations for me? Are they low expectations, or are they high expectations? Now, I'm going to do another a little piece here. It's a story, and I want you to listen to this story. There are only two characters. One is Mr. Parsons. Mr. Parsons is a very well-dressed, educated, employed person who is self-confident, and then there's a blind beggar. And the blind beggar's name is Markwart. So we have Mr. Parsons, and we have the blind beggar. And they have an interaction. And I want you to listen very carefully to this short story, and then we'll talk about it some more. Remember, Mr. Parsons and Markwart.
A Man Who Had No Eyes by McKinley Cantor. A beggar was coming down the avenue just as Mr. Parsons emerged from his hotel. He was a blind beggar, carrying the traditional battered cane and thumping his way before him with a cautious, half-furtive effort of the sightless. He was a shaggy, thick-necked fellow. His coat was greasy about the lapels and pockets, and his hands flayed over the cane's crook with a futile sort of clinging. He wore a black pouch slung over his shoulder. Apparently, he had something to sell. The air was rich with spring. Sun was warm and yellowed on the asphalt. Mr. Parsons, standing there in front of his hotel and noting the clack-clack approach of the sightless man, felt a sudden and foolish sort of pity for all blind creatures. And, thought Mr. Parsons, he was very glad to be alive. A few years ago, he had been little more than a skilled laborer. Now he was successful, respected, admired, insurance. And he had done it alone, unaided, struggling beneath handicaps. And he was still young. The blue air of spring, fresh from its memories of windy pools and lush shrubbery, could thrill him with eagerness. He took a step forward just as the tap-tapping blind man passed him by. Suddenly, the shabby fellow turned. "Listen, Governor, just a minute of your time." Mr. Parsons said, "It's late. I have an appointment. Do you want me to give you something?" "I ain't no beggar, Governor. You bet I ain't. I got a handy little article here." He fumbled until he could press a small object into Mr. Parsons' hand. "That I sell. $1. Best cigarette lighter made." Mr. Parsons stood there somewhat annoyed and embarrassed. He was a handsome figure with his immaculate gray suit and gray hat and malacca stick. Of course, the man with the cigarette lighters could not see him. "But I don't smoke," he said. "Listen, I bet you know plenty of people who smoke." "Nice little present," wheedled the man. "And mister, you wouldn't mind helping a poor guy out?" He clung to Mr. Parsons' sleeve. Mr. Parsons sighed and felt in his vest pocket. He brought out $2 half and pressed them into the man's hand. "Certainly, I'll help you out. As you say, I can give it to someone. Maybe the elevator boy would." He hesitated, not wishing to be boorish and inquisitive, even with a blind peddler. "Have you lost your sight entirely?" The shabby man pocketed the $2 half. 14 years, Governor." Then he added with an insane sort of pride, "Westbury, sir. I was one of them." "Westbury," repeated Mr. Parsons. "Ah, yes, the chemical explosion. The papers haven't mentioned it for years. But at the same time, it was supposed to be one of the greatest disasters in..." "They've all forgot about it." The fellow shifted his feet wearily. "I tell you, Governor, a man who was in it don't forget about it. Last thing I ever saw was C Shop going up in one grand smudge and gas pouring in all of the best busted windows." Mr. Parsons coughed, but the blind peddler was caught up with the train of his one dramatic reminiscence. And also, he was thinking that there might be more half dollars in Mr. Parsons' pocket. Just think about it, Governor. There was 108 people killed, about 200 injured, and over 50 of them lost their eyes, blind as bats. He groped forward with his dirty hand rested against Mr. Parsons' coat. I tell you, sir, there wasn't nothing worse than that in the war. If I had lost my eyes in the war, okay, I would have been well took care of. But I was just a workman, working for what was in it. And I got it. You're darn right, I got it. While the capitalists were making their dough, they was insured. Don't worry about that. They... Insured, repeated his listener. Yes, that's what I sell. You want to know how I lost my eyes, cried the man. Well, here it is. His words fell with the bitter and studied drama of a story often told, and told for money. I was there in Seesha, last of all the folks rushing out. Out in the air, there was a chance, even with buildings exploding right and left. A lot of guys made it safe out the door and got away. And just when I was about there, crawling along between those big vats, a guy behind me grabs my leg. He says, let me pass, you... Maybe he was nuts, I don't know. I try to forgive him in my heart, doesn't I? But he was bigger than me. He hauled me back and climbs right over me, tramples me into the dirt, and he gets out. And I lie there with all that poison gas pouring down on all sides of me and flame and stuff. He swallowed a studied sob and stood dumbly expectant. He could imagine the next words. Tough luck, my man. Now I want to. That's the story, Governor. The spring wind shrilled past them, damp and quivering. Not quite, said Mr. Parsons. The blind peddler shivered crazily. Not quite? What do you mean, you? That story is true, Mr. Parsons said, except that it was the other way around. Other way around? He croaked uneasily. Say, Governor. I was in Seashop, said Mr. Parsons. It was the other way around. You were the fellow who hauled back on me and climbed over me. You were bigger than I was, Markwart. The blind man stood for a long time, swallowing hoarsely.
I'll be right back.
He gulped. Parsons. I thought you... And then he screamed fiendishly. Yes, maybe so, maybe so. But I'm blind, I'm blind. And you've been standing here letting me spout to you and laughing at me every minute of it. I'm blind. People in the street turned to stare at him. You got away, but I'm blind. Do you hear? I'm... Well, said Mr. Parsons, don't make such a row about it, Mark Ford. So am I.
So, let's have a couple of comments about what you thought of that story. Give me your name first.
Faith Armstrong. Appearance is... It plays quite a bit in that story, how one is... has obviously made it in the world, and the others just kind of blindly accepted his that there's nothing he can do, and that's what he's going to be.
Okay. Appearances have something to do with it. They were both in exactly the same catastrophe, the same explosion, the same accident. They went blind on exactly the same day, probably at exactly the same moment.
Right.
And one of them ended up a blind beggar. And one of them ended up doing what?
Making something of his life.
Becoming the governor.
Selling insurance.
They have decisions to make. Nobody meant to blow the chemical plant up. Nobody meant to have them live a bad life. This is part of life. Blindness happens.
And
sometimes it comes on instantly, and sometimes it comes on slowly. But it comes on. And sometimes you don't get it until you're a senior. And you're used to seeing your whole life, and all of a sudden you're 75, you start losing your vision, your eyesight. You know, it's hard not to place happiness, joy, success, achievement, education. It's hard to place all of those things simply on the fact that you see or not see. They're not related. The public believes that we can't. And if we're not careful, we ourselves start playing the role of Marquardt, the blind beggar. What was the most telling thing about Mr. Marquardt?
So, Leon, Ron. The most telling for me was the choice that he took to be a beggar, and it was all about him making that choice compared to what he could have done, feeling the victim.
Wonderful. That's a good answer. They both went blind at the same moment. Now, do you think they both woke up the next morning probably discouraged? I think so.
Yeah.
I think they both did. You think they were both discouraged a week later?
Yeah.
I think so. How about a year later? Well, one of them has started probably by then in a different direction, and the one guy was still there. And then in 5 years or in 10 years. Now, the story told us how long ago it was. What was it?
14 years.
14 years ago. They've all forgot about us. If I'd been injured in the war, sure, they'd took good care of me. Now, this man doesn't have a good education. And he's worried about being taken care of. If I'd been injured in the war, they'd take good care of me. But no, it was just a chemical explosion. The capitalists got theirs, but the workers, I'm just blind. In other words, it is all about him. Good comment, Leon. Mr. Parsons, did you notice the contrast in appearance? That got brought up a while ago. But what about the confidence in the way they spoke? And the confidence that they exude simply by being on the street? That's a very short story that I hope will lay the groundwork for us to talk about the philosophy of the National Federation of the Blind. Many of you know a lot about our philosophy, and some of you may not know as much. It's okay. It doesn't matter how long you've been in, whether you're Walter Wartasek. Walter, how long have you... let's see, tell us briefly about how you got introduced to the NFB, Walter.
I got into the NFB in 1971.
Oh, hold on, I'm going to come back so I can hear you a little better.
Okay.
So you got introduced to the NFB in 1971.
Well, not quite, because in 1950, when I was in piano tuning school, there was a man there who was one of the charter members of the NFB. In Pennsylvania. But we were too interested in just getting what we wanted to get out of life and not caring about other people, so we didn't really pay much attention to him. So in 1971, I met a man in Massachusetts, and he spoke with me about responsibility and so on, and took me to a meeting. Happened to be the Brockton chapter of the NFB, and that was the beginning for my interest and work with the NFB. But about this story, I wanted to say one thing, that there was a playwright named Arthur Miller. I don't know if anybody remembers him or not. He did Death for a Salesman and a bunch of The Crucible and various other plays. And he said in one of his essays, he said, I was 37 years old, I walked around and I thought that somebody else was in charge of my life. And then I realized that I was in charge.
And good.
That made the difference to him. And that I feel that when you join the NFB, you realize that you're in charge of what you can do to make yourself part of the rest of the world, and also to teach other people how to be responsible.
Now, Walter and I did not rehearse this.
No, we didn't.
But I got to tell you, nothing could have been better to introduce this next part that I want to talk about.
Right.
Walter, thank you. And when he talked about one of the charter members, he's talking about people that got together in 1940 in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, under the direction of Dr. Jacobus Tenbroek, who earned two different law degrees from two different law schools. He had two different law degrees. And he taught at the University of Berkeley School of Law. And he was totally blind. And in 1940, he realized, you know, there are too many things being left to chance about the blind. There's too much being left to chance. And he wanted to organize because he realized that if he tried to change what the whole world believed about blindness, he would be a loud voice in the wilderness. He would be alone. But if he could get other like-minded blind people to join with him, then you see it becomes a vehicle for collective action. Let's all work together. And then we get more and more interest, you see? So he did that in 1940. And a man that was at that very first meeting first introduced Walter into the NFB. But it wasn't until 20 years later that he met another member of the NFB, and then he began to come to meetings. So everybody comes to it at their own pace, I understand. But I'm hoping that many of you will realize that there's something here for all of us, regardless of where you are in life. I would like to share with you what Walter was leading into. We need to realize and understand that we individually are responsible for our own success or failure. Society can dump on us. Okay, we feel discouraged. But we decide whether we're going to stay in that pile of dump or whether we're going to climb out. Now, people get discouraged. We have the choice whether we're going to remain discouraged or climb out and make a change in our lives. I remember being in Salt Lake City, and I had been called by a friend and asked if I would testify before our legislature. And I said, well, sure. I mean, I was practicing law at the time, litigating cases, and, you know, and it was the legislature needed to hear something, and they wanted to hear it from me, and so I went up there. And afterward, because I really needed to get back to my office, one of the people who worked at the blind agency agreed to give me a ride back to my office, me and another woman that had just testified. Now, just picture in your mind here. Here I am in a suit with a white shirt and a tie, and I was carrying a briefcase, and I had just testified before the Utah legislature, and I was getting into this car in the back seat. And the other blind woman who had testified was getting in the car in the back seat alongside me, you know, on the other side of the car. The driver came, got in the front seat, and at this point, everything's normal, right? But the driver did something I will never forget. Instead of getting in the front seat and facing forward, she got in the front seat, immediately turned around, and started reaching over the front seat and messing around the blind lady to my left in the back seat with me. And I said, whoa, what are you doing? And the woman said, hey, wait, what are you doing? Because she was getting groped and touched all about the waist and hips. And she said, well, it's my responsibility to keep you safe. I'm going to buckle your seatbelt. Now, wait a minute. Here is a woman. I don't know how wealthy she was or how educated she was or not. I don't know. But she was sighted, and therefore she felt above us. She felt more enlightened. She felt more intelligent and more responsible. And she, as a sighted person, was going to do it for us. And I said, wait just a minute. I'll buckle my own seatbelt. Now, I didn't always believe that about myself. I went down to a place called the Louisiana Center for the Blind. Yay. The Louisiana Center for the Blind is a place that provides rehabilitation training to blind adults. Well, they do blind youth and children during the summer months. But during the other months, it's a rehabilitation training center for blind adults. And you go and you learn how to do ADL skills, how to cook, how to iron, how to clean up the kitchen, how to set the oven, how to make cakes and pasta. I made pasta. Yeah. Now, folks, when I say I made pasta, I mean I made the pasta. I didn't get it out of a bag. I made the noodles.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to make noodles, but I did that by myself under blindfolds, completely blind. I fried chicken in a vat of hot grease. Is that unsafe?
No.
You bet it is.
Oh. Sorry.
You bet it's unsafe. But when sighted people fry chicken in a vat of grease, they take certain precautions.
Yeah.
I'm a blind guy. When I fry chicken in a vat of grease, then I also take precautions. But it doesn't mean I can't do it. So I learned those things. I learned in a wood shop how to use power equipment. And it was the experience in the wood shop one day that really enlightened me about this issue, about this safety issue. Mr. Jerry Darnell, JD we called him, is a sighted guy. I knew he was sighted because he had driven the van to go somewhere. So I knew he was sighted. But I couldn't tell by looking, of course, because I have on blindfolds. I'm getting my blindness training under blindfolds. And that's for a reason. And some people don't like it, but it's for a real reason. We believe that if you're going to learn the skills to be successful as a blind person, you really do need to learn to swim. I mean, that's the example I use. And to learn to swim, you need to actually get in the swimming pool. But all too often, some rehabilitation training centers want to take us by the hand and have us step into the shower and turn the warm water on and let us get a little wet and then take us out and think that we've now learned how to swim. You don't learn to swim in the shower.
No.
You learn to swim in the swimming pool. And so I was in the swimming pool. I was in the Louisiana Center for the Blind under sleep shades, really getting immersed. The director was blind. The secretaries were blind. The teachers were blind. Why is that important? Because I had role models and mentors. And when they said, here, do it this way, let me help you learn a different way of doing that, I couldn't say, oh, sure, you can do it. You have vision. No, they didn't. So if they could do it, I could do it. You see what a positive influence that was? Anyway, I was at the Louisiana Center for the Blind, and I was, you know, getting my own skills. By the way, I was age 50, 5'0". It's never too late, but it's better the earlier you are, the younger you are. Okay, so I went into the wood shop with my sleep shades on, and I heard Jerry Darnell. Now, he's a sighted guy, because he had driven the van, and I knew that. He said, Ron, come over, it's time, today I'm going to teach you the radial arm saw. In the entire wood shop, there's only one thing that was altered in any way. And that was the way we measure. We use a click rule instead of a tape measure. Tape measure's not going to help us a lot.
No.
Okay? So, I learned to use the click rule to measure. But the table saw, the drill press, the band saw, the radial arm saw, the lathe, the planer, the edger, all of those power equipment tools were right out of the box. They were the same as in any wood shop in America. No safety, no other special this or that or the other. But folks, I went into the shop class, he called me over there, and he said, "Ron, this is Radial Arm Saw." And he handed me something. He said, "Now," and he told me what it was. Well, I knew what it was. He handed me...
Hold on, which word is this?
He handed me a power cord.
Yes,
okay, the end of a power cord. And he said, "It's not plugged in. So you can do anything to this saw you want. Feel it everywhere. Let me show you. Here's the switch. Here's the fence. Here's the blade. Here's the block. Here's the teeth on the blade. Here's the handle." And he showed me these things and he said, "I want to teach you one rule, the two-hand safety rule." And, you know, basically it was you put your hand up here on the handle and you find the switch. Right after, you put your left hand down there on your piece of wood and you find where you want to cut it and you line it up against the blade. Okay, that's before you get your hand on the switch.
Yeah.
But you get the blade right where you want it because you can feel the blade and the teeth and you can feel the end where, you know, you've measured it, marked it with a click rule. Okay. And then you get your hand and you hold that wood against the fence and you tuck your left thumb in, because generally when we're holding something, our thumb is extended clear out. The left thumb is extended clear out to the left. I mean to the right. You tuck your thumb in, and then you hold that lock, and then you turn on the switch. And you get your hand, before you turn on the switch, you get your hand at least one full hand width away from the blade. So you know that blade is not going to cut your hand. You know that yourself. And he said, "So Ron, you know all the safety now. Find the switch," and I did, and he said, "It's plugged in, so it's ready to go. Let me know when you're ready to cut, but don't turn it on until I tell you." So I got the safety measures, and I got the hand on the handle, and I got my thumb on the switch, and I was feeling pretty comfortable because, you know, he's a sighted guy, and I knew that if I kind of got it wrong, he was going to say, "Wait a minute, you need to watch your left hand there," or, "Hey, take it easy, you're a little too close," or, you know. And I knew he would, because he doesn't want me to cut my hand off. And I finally felt okay, and besides, he would help me. And I said, "Mr. Darnell, I'm ready to cut." And he said, "Okay, Ron, before you turn on the switch, I want you to know I'm wearing my sleep shades.
Cool.
Go ahead and cut." Gulp. Jerry Darnell, the sighted guy, had put sleep shades on, and I wondered why he put his hand on top of my hands. It was to make sure that he had confidence, I guess, that I was keeping the rules. But did I have the confidence to keep the rules? Well, I thought about it, and I realized it's not his responsibility to keep me safe. I'm an adult. Now, we do keep our children safe. We have that responsibility. But as adults, we need to keep ourselves safe. We need to take responsibility. So I thought about it. I turned on the saw. I cut the board. Can you imagine what happened to my confidence that day? I realized that sighted people can give us valuable information and help. That's okay. But in a pinch, if I learn the right skills, I can also do it as a blind person. The confidence that I learned that day was almost overwhelming. That's what happens when a blind person starts to get real good training and realizing that you're responsible. You have to take responsibility for yourself. Mom can't make us do it. The next door neighbor can't make us do it. And you know, we have good teachers in rehab here. John McMahon is the head of the blind agency here. And Jim Phipps is in the Iris Network. And they have great teachers. And they're well-meaning. And I'm not saying that they're horrible. They're not. But you may want to give some thought about an immersion experience in blindness. And think about whether you could go to the Louisiana Center for the Blind or You know, we have one in Minnesota and one in Colorado as well. It's Blind Inc. in Minnesota and Colorado Center for the Blind in Denver. And Immersion, National Federation of the Blind's Training Center for the Blind, is an immersion experience, which means you're in the swimming pool. You're surrounded by water. Everybody there is blind. Now, the water, the swimming is only an example of what I'm trying to say. But you don't just learn a task. You learn to live. So when you go in, the people you meet are blind. When you go to eat lunch, the people you eat with are blind. When you go in the kitchen, everybody cooking is blind. When you go in the wood shop, everybody's blind. When you're learning to use a white cane, everybody is blind. Now, do they have any sighted people that work there? Well, sure. Yeah. They have to have drivers. But every other, you know, I think, I don't know, they got a couple of people that work there. Because they do need drivers, and they double as, you know, this, that, or the other. But the immersion experience is that from class, from 8 to 5, we all wear our sleep shades. And everything we do is done under sleep shades so that we can learn that it's okay to be blind. We can learn in our hearts that this can be done efficiently as a blind person. And your confidence starts growing and so forth. But what about at night? I'll never forget going into a training center for the blind in a state. I won't mention the state, but its initials are Florida. And I went into the training center there, and they thought they were doing really, really good training. And an announcement came over the loudspeaker, and it said, "Attention, attention, the garden hose is stretched across the sidewalk and at the back door. Please be careful. Attention, the garden hose is across the sidewalk near the back door. Please be careful." And I thought, what? Here's what happened at that training center. An O&M teacher would take a person and kind of teach them to follow the wall and kind of get, they'd go around the building and maybe they'd walk down to the next corner or whatever. And they would come back and say, "Oh, you did so well. You made it to the corner and back. Oh, watch out for that chair." In other words, they're trying to teach a skill, but the expectation is still low. Wait a minute. I just went out to the sidewalk and there's rushing cars everywhere, and you tell me to watch out for a chair? And then the loudspeaker comes up and says there's a garden hose over the sidewalk? If you're really using good skills, you'll find that chair with your cane. You'll find that garden hose. My point is that when you're using the skills right, you can do them as efficiently as sighted people. We believe that a blind person can do the same job in the same place as his sighted neighbor and do it just as well if he or she gets the skills of blindness and the opportunity. That opportunity is important, and society sometimes doesn't want to give us that opportunity. And we need to self-advocate for it. But if given the skills and the opportunity, we can do the job that a sighted person does. But it takes those two things.
It's now yours.
We sometimes need that encouragement from our sighted counterparts, don't we? We really do. No question about that. And isn't it great to have family?
Oh, yeah.
Because generally the family believes in us. But the family can also want to keep us in a certain mold because it's been working for them. And if all of a sudden you go and get some training and come back and you know some different skills now, the family needs to understand that, you know, they need to give you some space too. And I'll give you an example. I was at the Louisiana Center for the Blind. In fact, by that time I was working at the graduate school at Louisiana Tech University. And I was teaching classes on blindness. And I had the opportunity to go and be a national rep, like I am today, in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Cool.
And so I flew down to Las Vegas, and I took with me a blind young man. He was 23 or 24. I took him with me because he grew up in Las Vegas. His family was there. And I thought, hey, you know, I want to take him back with me to Las Vegas. And they can see, you know, the changes that he's made. And he was going to be part of the convention we were holding. And so he got packed, and I got packed, and we both met at a certain place, and we got a cab to the airport, and we got to the airport and made it through security and got to the airplane and found our seats in the airplane, sat down, rode all the way to Las Vegas, got out of the airplane, went to the baggage claim, collected our suitcases, and went out to the curb where his sister was going to pick us up. Well, I met his sister. Ron, this is my sister, Judy. Judy, this is Ron Gardner. I said, hey, nice to meet you. And Adam said, she is pregnant, and she also has a baby that's about 14 months old. And so I realized this mama is holding a baby and pregnant. Okay? 7 months pregnant.
Oh, wow.
Okay? So she said, oh, Adam, it's so good to see you. Oh, we've missed you. We've missed you. Here, let me take your suitcase. And she got his suitcase, went around to the back of the car, put the key in the trunk. This is a few years ago.
Yeah.
Put the key in the trunk, opened the trunk, and started to heave one-handed Adam's suitcase
Hello.
Into the trunk, pregnant and holding a baby.
Hello.
Now,
strong woman.
Not safe.
I said, wait, Adam. Adam. And he looked at me and, oh gosh. And Judy, here, I'll put that in the... In other words, he had learned all of these skills, but once he got in his own environment, he stepped right back in to be that person that he was before he left home. And the sister was so proud of all the, you know, accomplishments that he had made. But as soon as she was around him, they both just started doing the same dance. The big sister would take care of the little brother. Always. The big sister was going to put his suitcase in the trunk for him. There's no need for that. Now, if you want an easy life, just let everybody else do it for you. If you want no change, no improvement, let everybody do it for you. But if you want some change, it's going to take some effort. It's going to take some work. Now, this isn't for everybody. I understand that. And I'm not selling you anything. Walter told us that NFB Newsline is free. It is. And right now, I couldn't do my job very effectively if I didn't have the ability to read the newspapers and different magazines and keep up on current events. And I do it. I use Newsline. And I mean, come on, what a service, and it's free. But when we're with our families and with our, you know, our caretakers or, you know, whatever we want to call them, we need to allow them to change too. And be careful with them. Don't force. But life can change and it can become better.